Chapter 27. Mary sat quietly through the next few sets, waiting with increasing apprehension for her moment to arrive. Finally, it was time. The dancers left the floor, and the musicians, released from their labours, went in search of their supper. Now was the moment when the musical ladies stepped forward. Miss Bingley claimed the first place, striding confidently towards the piano, head in the air, to the general approbation of the room. She had chosen a very lively piece, which she attacked with great verve. She finished with a flourish, and turned beaming towards her audience, almost daring them not to applaud. When they did so, she basked in their praise for some minutes, before sweeping back to her seat, her pride evident in every haughty step she took. Mary swallowed hard. It was now or never. She stood up, her music in her hand. As she passed Elizabeth, to her amazement, she felt Lizzie grasp her arm. Her sister looked intently into her face, her hand tight on Mary's sleeve. "Give us something simple we can admire, and, I beg you, do not make it too long." Mary shook herself free and walked towards the piano. The vehemence of Lizzie's words unsettled her. She began to feel nervous. Anxiety welled up within her. But she rallied her courage and told herself she must be calm. Once seated, she put on her glasses, placed her music on the stand, raised her hands, and began. It was easier once she had started. She knew the piece so well that she hardly needed to think about it, and her disciplined fingers flew about the keys just as she wished. Her spirits rose. Surely she was acquitting herself exactly as she had hoped. She had made no mistakes. Her timing was perfect. Then, almost before she knew it, the sonata was at an end. She lifted her hands from the keyboard, her heart fluttering. It was over. Relief flooded through her. She looked up to face the company and was delighted to see signs of appreciation, a scattering of nods and smiles. A few listeners even offered up a little polite applause. She could not see Mr. Collins, but she knew he must be somewhere in the audience. He must have witnessed her success. An unaccustomed euphoria flooded through her. She would attempt her second piece with new confidence, and she would definitely accompany herself with a song. She began again with her cheerful Scotch air, but by the time she reached the second verse, she knew she had made a terrible mistake. Miss Allen had been right. Her skill was as a player, not a singer. Her voice was weak, her manner tentative. She simply could not do it. Fear made her even worse, and she quickly sensed she had lost her audience. At the far end of the table, a murmured conversation had begun. When she looked up from her music, she thought she saw the eldest Bingley sister make a mocking face to the younger. She began to panic. But what was she to do? To stop would be fatal. There was nothing for it but to press on as best she could. As she did so, she was certain she caught a meaningful look from Elizabeth directed towards their father. She thought she saw him respond, but she flicked her eyes downwards, determined to think of nothing but the music. When she finally stopped singing, there was some sympathetic clapping, for which she was profoundly grateful. Perhaps it had not been as bad as she imagined. But it quickly died away, and she could not deceive herself she had been well received. When she lifted her hands from the keyboard, they were trembling. For a moment she could not compose herself. Then she heard her father's voice, low and clear, above the general chatter. When she looked up, he was standing beside her, his arm held out towards her.
"That will do extremely well, child. You have delighted us long enough. Let the other young ladies have time to exhibit."
She was so astonished, so taken aback, that at first she did not know what to do. It took a moment before she understood. Mr. Bennet was there to stop her playing again, to lead her away from the piano. He held out his hand and beckoned her gently towards him. She blinked in confusion. He beckoned again, this time more insistently. She thought she might faint. But instead, she gathered up her music and followed him blindly as they wove their way through the guests, trying her utmost not to catch anyone's glance. Immediately, Miss Bingley was on her feet,
striding forward to reach the piano. Soon the room rang once again with her playing, as polished and as glittering as the lady herself. Mr. Bennet led Mary back to her seat. She sat down heavily. She could not meet his eye. He stood beside her for a minute or so, but when it was clear she did not intend to speak, he sighed and walked briskly away. Her face burned with shame. Everyone had seen. Her mother, Kitty, and Lydia. The horrible Bingley sisters. And of course, Mr. Collins. They had all watched as she had been so brutally and so publicly shamed. They had all seen. When, a little while later, Elizabeth arrived and sat next to her, Mary did not acknowledge her presence. "Come, Mary, don't be angry. You cannot expect to be the only one to play tonight." Her voice was consoling and she reached for her hand, but Mary, furious now, shook her off. "This was your doing. You made our father stop me." Now it was Elizabeth's turn to look away. When she finally met Mary's angry, wounded stare, it was plain she had decided to admit the truth of the accusation. She had the good grace to look a little abashed, as she conceded Mary was right. "I am sorry it was done so bluntly. Our father might have acted with more tact." She put out her hand again. "It was for your own good. I did not want to see you mocked. It really wasn't my intention to hurt you." Overwhelmed with indignation, Mary threw her music off her lap. The pages floated slowly to the floor and landed at her feet. "How could I not be hurt? Everyone saw. Everyone. And don't you dare tell yourself you did it for me. That's a lie. You did it for yourself, to spare you embarrassment in front of people you want to impress." Tears began to prick her eyes. "I did not think you could be so cruel, Lizzie." Elizabeth sat very still. For once it seemed she had nothing to say. Then Charlotte arrived and placed a comforting arm around Mary's shoulders, urging her not to cry and offering her a handkerchief to wipe her face. "Let us go and take a breath of air," she said softly. "Just the two of us." Elizabeth did not attempt to stop them or accompany them, but remained where she was. No one spoke to Mary or Charlotte as they made their way through the crowd. As they reached the door, they passed Mr. Collins, talking at the top of his voice to anyone who would listen. If he had been so fortunate as to be able to sing, he assured his audience, he would have had great pleasure in obliging the company with an air. "For music is a very innocent diversion, perfectly compatible with the profession of a clergyman." He was in excellent spirits and paid no attention at all as Mary passed him, leaning on Charlotte's arm. His indifference was for Mary the final blow. She supposed it was proper reward for her presumption. She did not know why she had allowed herself to imagine she was worthy of any man's attention, that there was anything she could do to please. Well, she had been properly punished for her foolishness, slighted and humiliated by those who were supposed to love her. And despite all she had endured, she loomed no larger in Mr. Collins's thoughts now than when he had first arrived at Longbourn. When they reached the garden terrace, Charlotte sat Mary down and spoke to her with the firm kindness with which one might address an unhappy child, urging her to consider that few people but herself would have noticed what happened, and none would have thought Mr. Bennet's intervention arose from anything but fatherly concern that she should not overexert herself. As for Lizzie, it was impossible she had meant Mary any real harm. They had both noticed her agitation earlier in the evening. She was not herself and had acted in the heat of the moment. But Mary was not to be consoled. "I think you know that isn't true," she replied. "She felt I had shamed her, and that if I went on, I should do so even more. That was her only consideration." She breathed in more deeply, trying to control her agitation. "She thought only of herself. I have always loved her the best of my sisters. I knew she didn't care for me as she used to. But until tonight, I never realized she was so bitterly ashamed of me." Charlotte squeezed her arm. "She was ashamed of everyone tonight. And if I know her at all, which I believe I do, she will now be more than a little ashamed of herself as well. Don't take things too much to heart. You look a little calmer now. Shall we go back in and see whether Lydia and Kitty have left us any ices? Mary wiped her eyes one last time, and they drifted back into the house. But although persuaded to go back inside, she refused to return to her old place near her mother. She could not bear the prospect of Mrs. Bennet's curiosity, and instead retreated to a chair at the very back of the room, where there was no danger of her being noticed by anyone. At first, Charlotte stayed loyally by her side, but eventually she agreed to rejoin the party, promising she would return regularly to see how Mary did. Once alone, it was a little easier for Mary to compose herself, and gradually she grew calmer. To keep her thoughts from returning to the moment of her humiliation, she forced herself to survey the company from her seat in the shadows. If she could not enjoy the ball herself, she might at least observe what others were doing. She began to find this strangely comforting. It soothed her mind to fancy herself above and beyond the emotions that governed everyone else at Netherfield. In this detached mood, she watched as Jane danced again and again with Mr. Bingley, her eyes cast modestly away from his admiring smiles. She stared at Miss Bingley, standing as close as she dared to Mr. Darcy, her sharp features consumed with longing when she thought he could not see. So that was how it was. She smiled bitterly and turned away. Elsewhere amongst the dancers, she could just make out Lydia and Kitty in the midst of the line, their dresses pale against their partners' brilliant uniforms, Lydia's face ecstatic as she whirled around. Emboldened by the sensation that she was not really there at all, Mary rose from her seat and walked a little further around the dark hinterland of the room. From there she saw her mother talking, holding forth to Lady Lucas, whilst her friend, head bowed, listened obediently. She caught sight of Mr. Collins, bobbing hopelessly around Elizabeth, his persistence defeating all her attempts to shake him off. Only when Charlotte appeared at her side did Lizzie finally escape. Mary's heart softened as she watched Charlotte bear Mr. Collins away, selflessly conducting him towards supper, chatting as she went. There was nothing Charlotte would not do to help her friends, even when, like Lizzie, they did not really deserve such consideration. When she was satisfied there was no more to see, Mary returned slowly to her chair. There she was surprised to find a small glass of strawberries placed on it, a silver spoon balanced on the rim. Puzzled, she looked about to see who might have left it there, suspecting it must have been Charlotte. But instead, it was Mr. Bennet's broad back that she glimpsed, hurrying away into the crowd. She picked up the glass and turned it round in her hand. She understood this was her father's way of making amends, the closest he would come to an acknowledgement that he had hurt her. She knew he would never willingly speak to her of what he had done, but if she had pressed him to tell her why he had left the strawberries without staying to present them himself, she could easily imagine his answer. "It has all the virtues of an apology, with none of the embarrassment of an explanation." Despite herself, she almost smiled. He would never feel for her what he did for Lizzie, but he had thought about her enough to bring her some strawberries. He knew he had hurt her and was sorry. She supposed that was something. She pulled the glass towards her and plucked one out, biting into it as tears again came into her eyes. Soon after, the ball drew to a close. It was late, past 2 o'clock, when the Bennets stood in the hall waiting for their carriage. Once they were settled inside, even Lydia's chatter soon subsided, her head leaning on Kitty's shoulder as she fell asleep. Everyone was silent, some from happiness, some from exhaustion, others from a consciousness that the evening had not turned out as they had hoped. Only Mr. Collins kept up a steady stream of conversation all the way back to Longbourn, quite untroubled by the fact that he received no reply. Chapter 28. Mary stayed late in bed the following morning. She did not feel ready to join the others. She knew the conversation would be all about the ball, and was certain her humiliation at the piano would be too compelling a subject to be tactfully ignored. She could imagine only too well the opportunities that topic would offer Lydia to tease her, and resolved to stay where she was until breakfast was over. Mrs. Hill brought her a dish of tea and offered to comb out her hair, but she would not be persuaded to leave her room. So it was that she missed the dramatic events that unfolded after the table was cleared. Even upstairs, she was aware something had happened. She heard the hurry of footsteps in the hall, and her mother's voice raised in angry exclamation. But these were not unusual occurrences, and it was only when Kitty and Lydia burst into her room that she understood what had caused them.
"Mary, you must get dressed and come downstairs," exclaimed Lydia. "There's been such an upset, you won't believe it."
"You can't imagine what's happened," cried Kitty. "You'll never guess in a million years."
Mary sighed. "That's probably true, but I really don't care."
"Oh, I think you will," said Lydia. "Even you will enjoy this."
"Are you going to tell me or not?"
"Mr. Collins has made Lizzie an offer," exclaimed Kitty. "And she refused him."
Mary sat up, her heart beating fast. She was not surprised Mr. Collins had declared himself. She had always thought he would do so. But she had not expected him to move so quickly.
"Mama is furious," said Lydia, throwing herself down on Mary's bed, "and says Lizzie will have him if she has anything to do with it. She carried her off to Papa so that he could make her see sense. But he told Lizzie her choice was a sad one, for her mother would never see her again if she refused to marry Mr. Collins, and he would never see her again if she did."
Kitty clapped her hands. "Isn't it killing?
And now everyone is cross."
Lydia leapt off the bed and seated herself at Mary's dressing table, turning her face from one direction to another, entirely pleased with what she saw.
"Mr. Collins has stormed off. Papa has shut himself in the library. Lizzie won't say anything at all, whilst Mama is beside herself and says no one takes any account of her feelings."
"It's quite the best thing that's happened this age," said Kitty with deep satisfaction. "What do you think, Mary?"
Mary lay back in bed. It was a good question, and one to which she did not have a ready answer. Her sisters ignored her silence for a while, chattering away between themselves about what might happen next. But when they saw that Mary did not find the business as amusing as they did, they went away and left her alone. She got up and began to brush her hair. She did not pose before the mirror, as Lydia had done, but looked directly into her reflection, as if asking herself what she should do now. She washed quickly. Mrs. Hill had brought up the water some time ago, and now it was barely warm, but she did not notice. She laid out a dress on her bed and sat down beside it blankly, as if she had forgotten what it was there for. Her mind was elsewhere. She had never imagined she would be the first sister to whom Mr. Collins proposed, but she had persuaded herself she might merit consideration as his second choice. If her efforts had succeeded, this should have been her moment. Once he had been refused by a woman who would never accept him, he might have been ready to listen to one prepared to say yes. It was now, when he was still smarting from Lizzie's rejection, that Mary had hoped to turn his thoughts to her, soothing his wounded pride and reminding him of the interests they shared, showing by her every word and gesture that she was the only Bennet sister he should seriously think of as his wife. But as she pulled her dress over her head, she realized none of these things would happen now. She would always be invisible to him. Even the public humiliation she had suffered at the piano had not been enough to capture his attention. She supposed she should be grateful her shame had passed him by, but oh, to be ignored and dismissed by a man like Mr. Collins. That was a harsh corrective to any ideas she might cherish about her own worth. As she struggled to tie her sash, she told herself she really had no right to be bitter. Her pursuit of him had been prompted solely by rational considerations. She could not claim her heart had been broken, and yet something within her cried out that it was not fair. She was the only one who had tried to see the good in him, who thought he had the potential to become a happier, better man, but it had not been enough to win him. Nobody wanted her, it seemed. Not even a man she did not love. When finally she made her way down to the drawing room, the first wave of the storm had passed, but anger and resentment hung heavy in the air.
Mrs. Bennet lay on the sofa, lamenting her woes to anyone who would listen. Lizzie stared out of the bay window that faced onto the orchard, her expression set and determined, refusing to respond to her mother's complaints. Mary did not know whom to approach, and stood uncertainly in the middle of the drawing-room, afraid to speak lest she draw their frustration upon herself. She could not have been more relieved when she heard the bell and Charlotte Lucas was announced. Charlotte had been invited to spend the day at Longbourn, but in the drama of that morning's events, this had been quite forgotten. Before she had taken off her hat and coat, Lydia and Kitty had gleefully imparted to her every detail of what had occurred. But to their disappointment, Charlotte had betrayed neither shock nor surprise. Instead, she had acted with characteristic calm self-command. Once in the drawing-room, she had laid a soothing arm on Lizzie's tense and angry shoulders, and had then approached the prone Mrs. Bennet, asking in a low, concerned voice if there was anything she could do to assist her.
"It is kind of you to think of me, my dear Miss Lucas, for no one is on my side. Nobody takes my part."
Charlotte offered to call for tea, a glass of water perhaps, but Mrs. Bennet brushed away her suggestions.
"If you really wish to help me, you will talk some sense into your friend over there. Insist she run after Mr. Collins as quickly as she can, and tell him with all the charm she can muster that she has changed her mind."
Charlotte looked towards Lizzie, who firmly shook her head, which provoked her mother to berate her even more.
"I tell you what, Miss Lizzie, if you take it into your head to go on refusing every offer of marriage, you will never get a husband at all, and I am sure I don't know who is to maintain you when your father is gone. I shall not be able to keep you."
Mrs. Bennet continued in this vein for some time, dwelling at length on Lizzie's inability to see a good thing when it was staring her in the face, until she was interrupted by the arrival of the gentleman himself. Mr. Collins had returned from his exile in the garden, and stood at the drawing-room door, the very picture of injured dignity, declaring that he should like to speak to Mrs. Bennet, if it was at all convenient. Mrs. Bennet roused herself reluctantly from her couch, declaring she was at his disposal for anything he wished to ask of her. Elizabeth immediately left her seat at the window and sailed past Mr. Collins without a word. Mary and Kitty dutifully followed her, but once she was on the other side of the drawing-room door, Mary was surprised to find that both Charlotte and Lydia were still within. She could only suppose they had contrived to make themselves as inconspicuous as possible, and, for that reason, had not been ejected. It did not surprise her that Lydia should behave in such a manner, but that Charlotte should do so was most unexpected. It was not long before Mr. Collins emerged, with the self-conscious air of a man who has just delivered himself of a weighty decision. He nodded towards his waiting cousins with a superior smile and walked swiftly away. Once he had disappeared, they crowded into the room, eager to find out what had been said. Mrs. Bennet had returned to her sofa, her eyes closed, her handkerchief placed over her face.
"I am not equal to describing what has befallen us,"
she announced in a low, disappointed moan.
"Go away, all of you, and leave me alone. Charlotte and Lydia can tell you what he said."
Once the door had been closed on Mrs. Bennet's grief, Charlotte leant heavily against it. Mary noticed that even she was now a little excited, her eyes brighter than usual. "He has withdrawn his pretensions to Lizzie's favour," she declared.
"Yes," cried Lydia. "He's pulled out. You've lost your chance, Lizzie. It's all over for you."
"His manner was more resentful than his words," Charlotte continued. "But he says he is resigned, and I think he means it. You need not fear he will renew his pursuit." Elizabeth fanned her face with an exaggerated gesture of relief. "I'm very glad to hear it. I don't think I could have borne much more of his good opinion."
"But some other poor girl may not be so lucky," added Lydia. "For he told Mama he still hopes to find himself an amiable companion. I very much hope it won't be me."
"You are rather young for that," said Charlotte. "I think you are safe enough. But it is clear he does still hope to discover some fortunate woman to preside over his parsonage." "Well, whoever she is,
She must form her own conclusions as to the desirability of an offer from Mr. Collins, Lizzie said, with a laugh, her good humour quite restored. I am only relieved to be free of him myself. With that, she took Charlotte's arm, and they walked into the garden to continue their conversation in the open air. With nowhere else to go, Mary made her way to the library, but once there, found she could not settle to her work. She wandered to the window, where she watched Elizabeth and Charlotte walking on the grass. Elizabeth was chatting to her friend with all the ease in the world. It was as if the painful events of last night had not taken place. She had said nothing to Mary about their bitter exchange, but then, thought Mary, as this morning demonstrated, Lizzie's life was so full of incident that perhaps she had already forgotten it. Mary's own humiliation must seem a small thing, easily blotted from Lizzie's mind when she had so many more extraordinary matters to think about. Or, Mary considered, perhaps it was she herself who was the small thing, and thus easily disregarded. No matter how distracted she might be, Elizabeth always had sympathy and consideration enough to lavish upon Jane. When a letter had arrived that morning from Miss Bingley, regretting that she, Mr. Bingley, and indeed all their party, had been urgently called away to London, no one could have been more attentive to her bereft sister than Lizzie was to Jane. Mary blew on the window and wrote her initials in the little patch of condensation. As she did so, she saw Mr. Collins appear in the garden, cross the lawn, and approach Charlotte and Lizzie. He bowed stiffly. Even from a distance, his discomfort at meeting Elizabeth was clear. But in an instant, with the smallest dip of a curtsy, Lizzie excused herself and walked away, quite slowly at first, her steps growing faster and faster until she was running towards the gate, flying out onto the path into Meryton. Once she had gone, Mary watched as Mr. Collins offered Charlotte his arm. Charlotte graciously accepted, and at a steady, unhurried pace, they made their way into the beech grove until they were quite out of Mary's sight. Chapter 29. The following night, the Bennets were engaged to dine with the Lucases. There had been some debate whether Mr. Collins would attend, but when applied to, he very pointedly declared himself more than willing to spend an evening where he was so sure of being pleased. When the family arrived that evening at Lucas Lodge, Mary was struck by how smart the rooms appeared. They were not lit and decorated with such attention when it was only the Bennets for supper, and Charlotte herself had taken equal trouble, dressed in an elegant white gown with green ornaments. "Is that a new dress, Charlotte?" asked Mary. "It looks very smart." "Yes, I decided a while ago to lay waste to my allowance and spend it entirely on fripperies. I don't suppose Dr. Fordyce would approve, but it does raise the spirits not to be the worst-dressed woman in the room for once." "That's most unfair. You are always very well turned out." "Thank you. But for once I feel rather better than that, and I must admit it's a very pleasing sensation." As Mary surveyed her, she thought there was indeed something different about Charlotte tonight. It was not only her new gown. There was an animation about her, a suggestion of excitement in her features which Mary had not seen before. When they went in to dine, Mary saw she was placed at the end of the table with Elizabeth and Lydia. Mr. Collins occupied the place of honour, and Charlotte was situated close by him. Mrs. Bennet was seated as far away from the two of them as politeness allowed. "Charlotte could not have been more obliging," whispered Lizzie, as the first course was served. "There is almost no chance of our being required to talk to Mr. Collins from here, unless he were to spend the evening shouting at us, which I think even he would hesitate to do." Mary nodded, but as the meal went on, she watched Charlotte with increasing curiosity. Her attentiveness to Mr. Collins was really very marked. She helped him to the best dishes, made sure his glass was filled, listened to his conversation with every appearance of interest, and laughed winningly when some active sign of amusement was called for. "Lizzie," Mary asked as the dessert was brought in, two delicate tarts and an ice decorated with spun sugar, quite unlike the homely puddings usually to be found on the Lucas's table, Do you think it possible that Charlotte is fond of Mr. Collins? Elizabeth looked at her, amazed.
Of course not. She's far too sensible for that. She is all generosity, and I am more grateful to her than I can possibly express.
But whenever Mary looked up, there was Charlotte, deferential and smiling, and there was Mr. Collins, his self-possession restored, looking as pleased and as satisfied as she had ever seen him. Mr. Collins was not at breakfast the following morning. He left word he should be out, and that he was not sure when he should have the pleasure of seeing them again. As she buttered her bread, Mrs. Bennet looked uneasy. His absence unsettled her and made her cross, and soon the lengthy reiteration of her familiar grievances drove everyone from the table except Mary.
"I am glad to have the opportunity to talk to you alone," began her mother. "Please attend, as I have something important to say to you."
Mary put down her cup.
"I have been thinking about Mr. Collins. Since Lizzie was so selfish as to refuse him, it has not been easy to know what to do next. Jane we may consider as already spoken for. Kitty and Lydia are very young to be thinking of marriage and are far too lively for him. So I have turned my mind towards you."
"Towards me?"
"Yes, I think you understand me. Do not trifle with me this morning, Mary. My nerves are not equal to the strain."
"I am sorry, Mamma, but when I asked you only a week ago to consider if I was not perhaps best placed of all my sisters to suit him, you were adamant I was not."
"Please don't be more vexing than you need to be. A great deal has changed since then, as even you must see."
"Yes, indeed, but I'm afraid we may have left it too late. I might have stood a chance at the beginning, especially if you had worked as hard on my behalf as you did for Lizzie, but I don't think he would have me now."
"Don't be ridiculous. Why on earth not? Who else can he ask? Let us hear no more of 'he will not.' But I need to be sure that you will accept him when he does offer. We cannot have a second refusal on our hands."
Mary looked down at the table as she felt herself flush with shame. "It really doesn't matter whether I will or will not take him. I promise you it is too late now. He won't choose me." Mrs. Bennet flung down her napkin and stood up, infuriated.
"You are a very silly, ungrateful girl, and there is no talking to you. But I'm not finished with you yet. We will speak about this again when I am feeling better."
She slammed the door as she left the room. Mary sighed and stared out of the window. She was surprised to see Charlotte Lucas walking down the drive to the house. She had not been expected this morning, but Mary thought her presence would be very welcome. Her steady manner was always beneficial when feelings ran high in the Bennet household, and if Mary was able to speak to her alone, she might discover more about her inclinations towards Mr. Collins. Perhaps her mother was right, and Mary had been mistaken. She supposed it would be useful to know. But although Mary waited for Charlotte to arrive, she did not appear. When Kitty passed the door, Mary asked if she had seen her and was told Charlotte had gone straight to find Lizzie. It seemed they had been closeted together in the drawing-room ever since. It was nearly half an hour before Mary heard the door open and close. Still, there was no sign of Charlotte. It was only when Mary looked out of the window that she saw her, walking briskly down the drive, clearly eager to be gone. Mary ran to the hallway, seized her coat, and ran after her. She was sure something was amiss and was determined to discover what it was. She caught up with Charlotte just as the drive opened up onto the lane. Out of view of the house, there she stood, breathing hard and flinging her gloves from hand to hand. Mary rushed towards her.
"Didn't you hear me calling you, Charlotte? Why didn't you stop?"
Charlotte looked up. Mary had never seen her so distressed.
"I'm so sorry," she said, trying to smile and failing. "I was so taken up in my own thoughts that I didn't hear you."
"Something has happened. I can see that it has. Won't you tell me what it is?" Charlotte seemed unsure how to reply. She paced up and down the dusty path, kicking the stones with her boots. Finally, she made her way to a low wall and settled herself upon it. She seemed a little calmer now. I suppose I may as well explain. Everyone will know about it soon enough, and you might understand better than most people why I have acted as I have." She pulled a few weeds from the wall and began to twist them in her hands. "Mr. Collins made me an offer of marriage earlier this morning, and I have accepted him. The wedding is to take place within the month." Mary sat down heavily beside her, so her suspicions had been right. "I felt it my duty to tell Lizzie before it was generally announced. I didn't think my decision would please her. We have always had such very different ideas on the subject of matrimony, but I did not expect—" Her voice trembled for a moment, and Mary saw her hands were shaking. "I confess, Mary, I did not expect her to greet my news with such horror and contempt." "Those are very harsh words, Charlotte." "She cried out when I told her. She declared the engagement impossible. I tried to explain my motives, that I asked only a comfortable home, that given his character and connections, I was as likely to achieve that with Mr. Collins as with any other man of my acquaintance. I reminded her I was not romantic. But she was not to be moved. The look on her face as I tried to justify myself was very painful to me." "It must have been a great shock to her. Once she's used to the idea, I'm sure all will be well again." "She soon recollected herself, and then she was polite enough, offering congratulations and wishing me all possible joy. But, oh, Mary, I can tell I have fallen very far in her estimation." She covered her face with her hands, and a sob escaped her. Mary knew only too well how it felt to have Lizzie's goodwill withdrawn from you. She searched for some words of comfort or reassurance, but found none. She took Charlotte's arm in hers, and they sat in silence until Charlotte cried no more. "I am glad you followed me," she said haltingly. "I was afraid I might have forfeited your friendship, as it seems I have Lizzie's. I thought you might feel that I have, as they say, cut you out, that in securing my own future, I have denied you a similar chance of escape." A strong breeze blew, and Mary realized she had rushed out without her hat. If anyone were to see them, it would seem a very strange situation. Two young women perched on a wall, the wind whipping at their skirts, one of them hatless. But, thought Mary, if that person had heard their conversation, they would have found it even more extraordinary. She hesitated before replying, unsure how candid she should be. But she had nothing to lose now. Why should she not tell Charlotte the truth? "It is true, I wondered whether it was not my duty, to my family as well as to myself, to try to persuade Mr. Collins to marry me. But I couldn't manage it. No matter what I did, he was quite indifferent." "You're very hard on yourself. You might have done better, given more time," Charlotte said, almost herself once more. "But I couldn't afford to be over nice on this occasion. An opportunity of this kind might never offer itself to me again. I am too old to be generous, even to you." Charlotte slid off the wall and resumed her pacing, crossing and recrossing the path as she spoke. "I cannot pretend I love him. As you have said yourself, he can hardly be considered a sensible man. But if I had any doubts I had done the right thing, they vanished when I told my family about his offer. I've never seen my parents more overjoyed, and my brothers were almost speechless with relief. I won't be a dead weight on their hands now. They all thought I was destined to be an old maid, but now I will have a husband, and can look forward to a home of my own. One day, of course, that home will be Longbourn." Charlotte had the grace to look self-conscious. "But not for many years, I hope." In the wood just beyond the path, a great crowd of rooks flew into the air, shouting and cawing angrily as they rose above the trees. "Longbourn will belong to Charlotte," thought Mary. "It might have been mine if I had succeeded with Mr. Collins, but I failed, and instead he has chosen Charlotte." She stared at the birds as they wheeled in the sky, quite indifferent to her pain. That Mr. Collins should want to marry Jane or Elizabeth was only to be expected.
One only had to look at them to understand. But what had Charlotte to recommend her? Why, Mary asked herself, was she his choice and not me? You have been so honest with me, Charlotte, and I hope you won't object to my being equally direct with you. Please do not spare my feelings in your answer. I should like to know why you believe Mr. Collins preferred you to me. Charlotte stopped her pacing and joined Mary once more on the wall. She was not at all offended at the question. I suppose you could say that my flattery was more determined, my eagerness to please more insistent. I'm sure Lizzie would argue I was readier than you to surrender my pride and conquer my feelings in pursuit of worldly advantage. She picked up a stone from the path and threw it as far as she could into the field beyond, as if dismissing Lizzie's opinion with the same vehemence. But I think there is another difference between you and me. I have never hidden from you that I am unhappy in my circumstances and planned to do all I could to change them. But it is my situation I dislike, not myself. I'm not sure the same is true of you. It's hard to persuade anyone, especially a man, that your regard is worth having if you have none for yourself. The breeze was a proper wind now, and Charlotte shivered. She pulled her coat tighter around her and stood up, ready to go. And that, I promise, is the last piece of advice I shall ever offer you. Please try to think of me as generously as you can. I should warn you that my father intends to call upon your family later today and inform them of the coming happy event. I don't imagine what he has to say will be much to Mrs. Bennet's taste. Chapter 30. When Sir William Lucas appeared at Longbourn that afternoon, his announcement that his eldest daughter was shortly to be united with Mr. Collins was met at first with astonished disbelief. As Mr. Collins himself had taken pains to ensure, with a combination of tact and apprehension, that he was away from home at this critical moment, he could not be applied to, either to confirm or contradict the report. But at first it seemed impossible to credit.
"Good Lord, Sir William, how can you tell such a story?" exclaimed Lydia. "Do not you know that Mr. Collins wants to marry Lizzie?"
Sir William admitted he understood this had indeed been so, but that it was no longer the case. Mr. Collins's affections were now fixed upon a different object, and there could be no doubt of his intending to marry his daughter as soon as was convenient. Elizabeth, who could no longer bear to see him so obviously disbelieved, raised her voice above the confusion to agree that all Sir William said was true, for she had heard it from Charlotte's own mouth just a few hours before. At the same time, she sought to put a stop to the exclamations of incredulity of her mother and her sisters by offering Sir William congratulations as fulsome as could be justified on such an occasion. Jane joined in with great good nature, and even Mary managed to wish them well, but Mrs. Bennet said almost nothing at all until Sir William took his leave. Then her anger was quite as terrible as Mary had feared. At first, she refused to believe the story at all. Then, gradually, her mood shifted from doubting its veracity to abusing those at its heart. Mr. Collins had been taken in, and by what means she did not like to consider. Who knew what methods Charlotte Lucas might have employed to ensnare him? She had always thought her a sly, untrustworthy girl. She hoped the match might still be broken off, and if it was not, then she wished they might never be happy. If Elizabeth had done as she ought and accepted him, now it would be she, and not Lady Lucas, who was planning a daughter's wedding. But no one attended to a word she said. Her wishes were always disregarded. When Mr. Collins eventually returned, an atmosphere of superficial politeness was, for a few painful hours, restored. Over the dinner table, Mrs. Bennet even managed to offer him a few chilly congratulations, but it could not be said to have been an enjoyable evening. Everyone except the future bridegroom was subdued. Only he seemed unconcerned, referring with no discernible embarrassment to his dearest Charlotte
and observing how often it was that an initial setback was eventually revealed to be a blessing in disguise, heralding as it did a prize of even greater value.
"In your case," observed Mr. Bennet, "the time between the two events was mercifully short, was it not?"
Mr. Collins agreed, quite unembarrassed, that this was indeed so, and he did not count it as the least of his blessings that he had not been obliged to wait too long for his good fortune. Perhaps more to his listeners' liking was the information that he did not intend to trouble them much longer with his presence at Longbourn, but would return as soon as possible to Kent and arrange his affairs there. He hoped, however, that they would not object to his visiting them again in a few weeks' time. As he and his amiable Charlotte were to be joined in matrimony at Meryton, it would be of incalculable convenience if he could persuade them to accept him once more as their guest. It was impossible to say whether gratitude at his going so quickly, or disappointment at the speediness of his return, was uppermost in the minds of those around the table, but when the meal was over, only Mr. Collins seemed entirely happy with the way events had unfolded, laying down his napkin with every appearance of complete satisfaction. His departure did nothing to improve Mrs. Bennet's temper. She was teased, as it was intended she should be, by frequent visits from Lady Lucas, who, in the first flush of her surprise at Charlotte's news, seemed to have briefly thrown off her usual deference, missing no opportunity to confide to her friend how delightful was the prospect of having her eldest daughter so respectably and imminently married. This could not help but remind Mrs. Bennet of the continued and inexplicable absence of Mr. Bingley, who appeared to be in no hurry to return to Netherfield and make Jane the offer which she had so publicly anticipated. She had even begun to weary of scolding Elizabeth, who could never be brought to show a proper sense of guilt for what had happened, no matter how frequently it was pointed out to her. Humiliated and resentful, Mrs. Bennet sought a new target with which to occupy herself, and soon it was Mary who felt the lash of her displeasure. Turning over in her mind every detail of what had taken place in the days before Mr. Collins's proposal, it did not take Mrs. Bennet long to convince herself that Mary knew more than she had hitherto disclosed about Charlotte's intentions towards Mr. Collins, and during many an otherwise aimless hour, she sought to extract from her daughter any information that might rebound to Charlotte's discredit.
"When I told you I was ready to think of you as a possibility for Mr. Collins, I recall you saying it was too late. I wonder, Mary, what you meant by that. Did you know that Charlotte was already scheming to catch him?"
"I really couldn't say, Mamma. I merely observed that she was often in his company, and that she paid him a lot of attention. I believe we all thought it was a kindness on her part to distract him away from Lizzie."
"She was certainly very successful at that," declared Mrs. Bennet scornfully. "She distracted him into making her the offer that should have been ours. I can't imagine why you didn't mention it to me. I should have put a stop to it very sharply, I can tell you."
"I think Mr. Collins had already decided that if he couldn't have Lizzie or Jane, he would look elsewhere. I don't think it was entirely Charlotte's doing. It seems very unfair to blame her for her own good fortune."
"How can you be so foolish? One of you should have snapped him up, as I said on numerous occasions. Lizzie was wilful and wicked, and would not have him, and you would not exert yourself enough to try. To have been outmanoeuvred by that cunning little minx, Charlotte Lucas, is unbearable. You and Lizzie are both to blame, and I cannot forgive either of you for it."
There seemed no point in reminding Mrs. Bennet of the conversation in which Mary had offered herself up as a prospect for Mr. Collins's hand, and of her peremptory rejection of it. Mary knew it would only fan the flames of her mother's anger. As it was, her presence, which had always irritated Mrs. Bennet, now provoked her almost beyond endurance. Her daily practice at the piano was painful to her mother's ears. Her books cluttered up the drawing-room. There was ink on her fingers, had she not noticed it? She was to scrub it off this minute. This was not a counting-house, and she was not a clerk. Was there nothing she could do about her hair? It made her mother itch to find her scissors. Could she not put on a more becoming dress?
The colours she wore were as dull as ditch water. But nothing roused Mrs. Bennet to anger so much as Mary's spectacles.
"I warned that no man would marry you if you wore them, and I'm afraid to say I have been proved right. If I had had my way, perhaps things now would be very different, but that we shall never know."
On and on her mother went, the waves of her displeasure breaking over Mary like a rough and unrelenting sea. There was nothing to be said and nowhere to hide. When Mr. Collins returned at the end of a fortnight, Mary was almost relieved, for his presence required Mrs. Bennet to rein in her complaints, in public at least. Mary hoped his arrival might encourage Charlotte to visit Longbourn again. Once so regular a guest, she had not been seen there since the announcement of her engagement. Mary believed she absented herself, knowing that her presence was offensive to Mrs. Bennet, but she suspected that she was also avoiding Elizabeth. Their last interview had been painful for them both, and their attachment had cooled as a result. Sometimes Mary thought she missed her more than Lizzie. She had come to think of Charlotte as her friend, and felt the loss of her company very keenly. But with circumstances as they were, she had not thought it wise to risk her mother's disapproval by calling at Lucas Lodge herself. And it was some time before they met again, when Mr. Collins brought her on his arm one afternoon to tea. Mary had looked forward to seeing her again, but when Charlotte sat down at the tea-table, it was soon apparent that this was not to be the cheerful encounter she had hoped for. Charlotte came very much in the character of Mrs. Collins's fiancée, rather than an old friend of the family, and Mary was given no time at all to talk to her in private. Instead, the little party sat in formal state, making conversation that would never have suggested to a stranger that, with the exception of Mr. Collins, these people had known one another all their lives. Their frosty reception did not encourage Charlotte and Mr. Collins to stay very long. Once they were gone, Jane and Lizzie soon stole away, and Lydia and Kitty quickly followed. As dusk fell, Mary found herself alone in the drawing-room with her parents. She picked up her book and tried to lose herself in its arguments, but her mother's voice, angry and querulous, and her father's replies, designed to tease and annoy, made it impossible to concentrate.
"It was inexpressibly distasteful for me to have to receive them, and worse still to be obliged to be civil to that odious Charlotte."
"As you didn't seem to exert yourself overmuch in the direction of civility, it is to be hoped you will recover very quickly."
"Did you see her looking about the place as if she already owned it? They were speaking very low together in the hall, and I couldn't hear what they said, but I'm sure they were discussing what they should do with Longbourn when it is theirs. Did you not observe it, Mr. Bennet?"
Mary's father replied that he had not, but Mrs. Bennet took no notice, and the recital of her grievances went on. As she sat silently in the corner, it struck Mary with painful force that this was how she would spend the rest of her life. Her sisters would marry, and she would be the only daughter left at home, with no one to talk to and nothing to do. She would be obliged to listen to her mother's complaints day after day, month after month, year after year.
"Indeed, Mr. Bennet, it is very hard to think that Charlotte Lucas should ever be mistress of this house, that I should be forced to make way for her, and live to see her take my place in it."
"My dear, do not give way to such gloomy thoughts. Let us hope for better things. Let us flatter ourselves that I may be the survivor."
It was as if a great abyss had opened up before Mary, and in it she saw nothing before her but loneliness. In the space of a moment, she understood how fervently she longed for affection. She would not say love, for that seemed too much to ask. A spark of fellow-feeling would be enough, a little warmth to make the time pass more pleasurably. Her books alone, she realized, would never entirely suffice. Even her music seemed pointless. No one cared what she played as long as it drew no adverse attention from others. Her chief purpose in life appeared to be the avoidance of notice. Her heart contracted with pain. It was almost too much to bear.
"I cannot stand to think that they should have it all. If it was not for the entail, I should not mind it."
What should you not mind?
I should not mind anything at all.
Let us be grateful, then, that you are preserved from such a state of insensibility.
Perhaps Charlotte had made the right choice. Now she could look forward to a husband and a home, with children, perhaps, to come. She would have a position in the world and a purpose in life. It was true she had paid for her better prospects by marrying a man she did not love, but she did not seem to regret the bargain she had made. Mary had watched her closely today, observing her already managing Mr. Collins with a smiling deftness, never giving any hint she found his behaviour ridiculous or his presence annoying. Charlotte was all deference to her husband-to-be, though Mary saw, too, that she revealed nothing of her real self in his company. She would never be truly natural with him. She would never pay him the compliment of letting him know what she really thought or felt. Was that the kind of companionship Mary wanted? A union based on a lie? She looked around the room, taking in every familiar detail. The curtains faded at the edges by the sun, the stain on the carpet where her father had once spilt a glass of red wine and which no amount of scrubbing could remove. And it seemed as though the walls closed in around her. She might never escape their confines now. She had done all she could to act as reason dictated and find a way out, but it had not answered. It was Charlotte who carried off the prize. It was she, and not Mary, who had sat beside Mr. Collins all afternoon, with her mild, guarded smile and air of defiant satisfaction, avoiding the touch of his hand as they discussed the arrangements for their wedding. Charlotte had found her release, and Mary could not blame her for it, but she knew she wanted something more. Mary had done all she could to suppress it, but she longed to feel emotions that were honest and true, that were not intended to flatter and deceive. Yes, she could not deny it. She yearned to meet a man who would put an end to her loneliness, who would not think her awkward and plain, who liked the things she liked and did not think them foolish, a man whom she could love and who would love her back in his turn. She felt almost light-headed as she admitted the truth of it to herself. But almost as soon as the thought took shape, doubts and fears crowded in upon her. Where would she meet such a man? Not in Longbourn, that was certain. And even supposing she did, why would he look at her? What had she to offer? It was weakness to entertain such imaginings. Allowing yourself to think them only made their absence harder to bear.
How anyone can have the conscience to entail away an estate from one's daughters, I cannot understand. And all for the sake of Mr. Collins, too. Why should he have it more than anyone else?
I leave it to yourself to determine.
Mrs. Bennet was finally silenced. The clock ticked and the fire crackled. Mary closed the book which sat unread before her. She must resign herself to circumstances that were unlikely to change. She rose from her seat, picked up the poker, and began to stir the coals.
Part 2. Chapter 31. 2 years later. Mary had brought a book with her, but the jolting of the carriage made it impossible to read. For a while she tried her best, anxious to have something to occupy her mind. But after an hour or so, she gave up and threw the book aside. She wiped the corner of the dirty window with her handkerchief and watched the countryside pass by. They were not far from Longbourn now. Every house, every cottage, every hedgerow was familiar. There was the orchard where the best plums were to be had. There was the field where the bull had charged the cowman's son, who had distracted it with his hat. And there was the path to Meryton, down which she had so often walked, trailing behind Kitty and Lydia, wondering what she should do with herself whilst they rushed into the milliner's shop to spend their allowance. The landscape looked as it had always done. But for the family who had once lived so quietly in this damp green corner, everything was different. Mary stared at the trees, her inward eye recalling the events which, one after another, had shaken them up and turned them inside out. Lydia's elopement with Mr. Wickham had been the first of the dramas. Lydia had always been wild and impulsive, but no one had imagined her thoughtlessness would have quite such far-reaching consequences. When news of her flight first broke upon them, there had seemed nothing to be done. Mary still recalled her father's defeated look as he trudged into the hall at Longbourn, returning empty-handed from a fruitless search for the couple in London, his eyes bleak, his face grey, his habitual expression of ironic detachment quite extinguished. Then, against all expectations, a marriage ceremony had been somehow arranged. The slippery Mr. Wickham bribed or threatened into walking an eager Lydia up the aisle. At first it was not known how it had been contrived. The revelation that it was Mr. Darcy to whom the Bennets owed their youngest daughter's hurried nuptials was received with as much, if not perhaps more, astonishment than Lydia's actual running away. It was hardly to be wondered at that the family prejudice against him ebbed away somewhat as a result. But, with the possible exception of Jane, none of the Bennets foresaw what was to happen next. No one could quite believe it when Elizabeth confessed that Mr. Darcy had made her a proposal of marriage, and they were even more astounded when she announced she had accepted him. Mary was incredulous. How could she marry a man she had always declared to be proud, cold, and disdainful? Lizzie insisted he was not like that at all. She had misjudged him. Pride had blinded her to his true nature. She argued the case for his virtues with all the warmth with which she had once denounced his vices, and gradually her passion turned the tide of family opinion. Once the fact of Lizzie and Mr. Darcy's love for each other had been acknowledged, for no one who saw them together could believe it was not so, their union seemed as inevitable and as right as that of Jane and Mr. Bingley, which took place with similar haste, none of those involved seeing any reason for delay. The weddings had rendered Mrs. Bennet almost speechless with joy. Three daughters married in the course of a year, the two eldest to men of consequence and standing. It was everything she had always hoped for. Neither she nor her remaining daughters would starve or be thrown upon the parish. She could hold her head up once more amongst her friends and enjoy the superiority she felt was her due. In no time at all, her manner towards Lady Lucas was again one of condescension, for the mother of the mistress of Pemberley had nothing to fear from the parent of mere Mrs. Collins. When Kitty was claimed the following year by a respectable clergyman with a handsome living, her satisfaction was complete. The triumph of her eldest daughter's marriages enabled her to turn her head away from the irregularities of that of her youngest. Mrs. Bennet never spoke of the way Lydia's marriage had been brought about, nor of the rackety existence which Mr. and Mrs. Wickham subsequently led, moving from place to place, never settling and always in need of funds. Sometimes she sent Lydia small gifts of money to help her in any immediate difficulty, but she always made sure Mr. Bennet knew nothing of it. His sympathy for the misfortunes of their youngest daughter was never as extensive as her own, especially when he was called upon to express it in pecuniary form. With her sisters gone, Mary soon felt herself sinking into the existence she had so long dreaded. Her days went by with little variety. She studied and she practised at the piano, her music echoing through the empty house. But she quickly discovered she had less time for her pursuits than before, for Mrs. Bennet could not bear to sit alone for long and found even Mary's company preferable to her own. These were the hours Mary found hardest, for her mother had nothing to say to her, and in the absence of any affectionate kindness, readily fell back into querulous complaint. It was a relief to them both when Mrs. Phillips called, for then Mary was permitted to retreat to the library. Her aunt's voice, however, was loud and carried far beyond the drawing-room, and it was by this means Mary discovered how her situation was viewed by those who considered it at all.
"What a blessing it is for you to have Mary still at home," observed Mrs. Phillips one airless afternoon. "I'm sure you would be quite solitary without her."
"Perhaps," replied Mrs. Bennet, unconvinced.
although she has no conversation of the kind I enjoy.
But it must be easier for her now, that she's no longer mortified by comparisons between her sister's looks and her own. That cannot have been easy for a young girl. Now she will be judged on her own terms, and who knows where that might lead.
You have always spoken in her favour, sister, and I thank you for it. But I see no likelihood she will change her situation any time soon. She and I must rub on together for a few years yet. It is a burden I must learn to bear. Will you have a little more tea?
Mary tried not to brood too much on what the future held. She was more of her mother's opinion than her aunt's, and considered it a day well spent if she got through it without falling into despair. But then, when it was least expected, an event took place which overturned forever the fragile certainties on which Longbourn had been balanced for so long, shattering the expectations of both mother and daughter. The existence of the entail had made Mr. Bennet's death the subject of much conversation over the years, but it had been so often talked about that no one had supposed it would actually occur, or not, at least, for many years. When he died in his sleep, with no warning of his impending end, the shock to his family was as dreadful and as surprising as if its possibility had never been mentioned before. The distress of his wife and daughters was severe and sincerely felt. None of them could imagine life without him. But all the sisters, except Mary, had husbands to comfort them, and new obligations to fill the place he left in their hearts. On the day of his funeral, Mary took from her drawer the little book of extracts she had composed for him with such hopeful affection, held it in her arms, and cried without restraint. She would never now enjoy the satisfaction of having pleased him, of seeing his eyes light up in pride at something she had done. It was true such a possibility had appeared increasingly remote as the years went by, but she had never quite given up on the hope that one day it would happen. The certain knowledge that now it could never do so was perhaps the sharpest pain that grieved her.
Chapter 32. When all the formalities had been observed, Mary accompanied her mother to the north of England, where they were to stay with Mr. and Mrs. Bingley until a more permanent settlement could be made for them. However, Mrs. Bennet had not been long in their house before it was apparent she would never willingly leave it. The loss of Mr. Bennet seemed to weigh less heavily on her nerves with Jane to look after her and Mr. Bingley to ask how she did with such regularly solicitous attention. Mary, however, did not find her sister's home so comfortable. She was grateful for the invitation to stay, but somehow she could not settle. Jane was never less than gracious, but her kindness did not put Mary at her ease. There was something distancing in Jane's benevolence, bestowed as it was equally upon both those who deserved it and those who did not. It was an admirable quality, but spread so generally that Mary knew it implied no special warmth for her. Jane's strongest affections were reserved for Mr. Bingley and Lizzie. Only they were granted access to her private heart, and Mary knew she would never be invited to join them. This knowledge made Mary's dependency upon her sister harder to bear than if there had been warmer affection between them. However, she thought she could have borne this if it had not been for the presence of Caroline Bingley in the household. This lady had none of her brother's charm and affability. She had always been of a proud, resentful disposition, but disappointment had soured her still further. As Mary had seen at the Netherfield ball, her feelings for Mr. Darcy had been strong, and she had hoped one day to secure him for herself. It had been a cruel humiliation to see another woman preferred, but to have lost him to Elizabeth Bennet, who had neither fortune, family, nor long acquaintance to recommend her, was all but intolerable. In consequence, Caroline Bingley was unhappy and angry in equal measure, but, it being impossible to vent her frustration on Mrs. Darcy, she decided to console herself by abusing her sister in her place. She did not open her campaign until she considered sufficient time had passed since Mr. Bennet's death, for there were niceties to be observed, even in spite. But once she was satisfied that brief amnesty had expired, Miss Bingley was relentless. She was an accomplished practitioner in the art of insult, and knew exactly how to deliver pain in a few well-chosen words, always pronounced with a smile. She began with Mary's clothes, which presented her with a very obvious target, but one she did not disdain to seize. "How refreshing it is," she remarked one afternoon at tea, "to see a young woman with the courage to defy the dictates of fashion, or indeed those of human nature itself, for most of us are foolish enough to want to look as well as we possibly can. I salute you, Miss Bennet, as an example to us all." Mary could think of no reply, and hung her head, unable to meet Miss Bingley's hard, unflinching simper. She was equally lost for words when, a few days later, Miss Bingley begged, with a very arch expression, for the honour of her advice. She had been asked by a friend who had recently engaged a governess to suggest a suitable dressmaker, whose fees recommend her more than her taste, and she felt sure Mary would know just such a person. When she had exhausted the subject of her appearance, Miss Bingley turned to Mary's books, picking them up and reading out their titles in tones so pompous that both they and their reader were made to look ridiculous. "Only a very superior understanding could rise to the challenge of such works, or one which had no other distractions with which to occupy itself. Scholarship is a fine thing, no doubt, but I am not sure I should wish to acquire it at the cost of every social grace." On and on it went. Mary bore it with all the resignation she could muster. Sometimes she looked around to see if anyone else had observed Miss Bingley's jibes, but they were spoken in such low, confiding tones that no one seemed to notice them. Mrs. Bennet rarely concerned herself with Mary at all, and Jane seemed so cocooned in happiness that it was impossible anything unpleasant could penetrate her contentment. Only once did Mary catch a disapproving glance directed by Mr. Bingley towards his sister, after she made a particularly disobliging remark in his hearing. But far from correcting her behaviour, his mute rebuke merely encouraged her to take more trouble in concealing it. For a while, Mary hoped Miss Bingley would grow tired of attacking her, but the weeks went past with no slackening in either her tormentor's energy or ingenuity, and Mary began to wonder for how much longer she could stand it. She did her best to ignore her, attempting neither to acknowledge nor respond to any hurtful words. But her courage wavered as she understood Miss Bingley's desire to wound was far greater than her ability to withstand it. One night, as she sat alone in the drawing-room waiting for the rest of the company to arrive, Mary found herself looking with interest at the piano, which occupied pride of place there. It was polished and gleaming, but very seldom used. She did not think she had heard anyone attempt it since she arrived. She walked across to it and raised the lid, wondering how it would sound, how the keys would feel under her fingers. It was only when she was seated at the keyboard that it struck her that this must be the very instrument on which she had been playing when her father had so humiliatingly put an end to her performance at Mr. Bingley's ball. A shiver ran through her as she recalled the shame she had felt, the frantic desire to vanish into thin air. She had not performed in company since, and thought she would never do so again. She trailed her fingers lightly over the keys and struck a single note. The piano was in tune. For a moment she hesitated, the horror of that evening fresh again in her mind. But it had been so long since she had played, especially on an instrument as fine as this. The keyboard was so inviting, the keys so smooth and well-balanced. The urge to play overwhelmed her, and before she knew it, she was tearing into a Scottish air with a tremendous attack, quite unlike her usual precise style. It was the very piece which had sealed her fate on that dreadful night, extinguishing so many of her hopes. She had not consciously chosen it, but once she knew what it was, she could not let it go.
but drove it passionately towards its conclusion. She was breathless when she finished, lost in the powerful emotions the music had awakened in her. It was only when she felt more composed that she looked up from the keyboard and saw Caroline Bingley standing by the door. It was impossible to say how long she had been there. She smiled her icy, ingratiating smile.
"Please don't say I've left it too late to hear more."
Miss Bingley walked towards the piano, her fan in her hand, her expression demure.
"Or perhaps you fear you have delighted us enough already."
Mary's eyes filled with tears. She could not speak, but stood up and hurried to the door. She caught a glimpse of Miss Bingley's face as she passed, alive with pleasure at having finally found the tenderest place on which to land her blow. As Mary ran upstairs to her bedroom, she knew she could stay with Jane no longer. Her spirits were not robust enough to repel Caroline Bingley's spite, and she saw that if she remained, she would soon become accustomed to her attacks, shrinking a little more each day under her blows until she thought she deserved no better. No, she would not allow herself to become Miss Bingley's cowed and willing victim. If she was not prepared to fight, then she must retreat, and do so quickly. Pemberley was not far away. Why should she not write to Elizabeth, asking if she might spend a little time with her there? The more she thought about it, the more the idea pleased her. Pemberley would offer her a refuge from Miss Bingley's bullying, a haven of peace and quiet where she could lick her wounds and recover. But perhaps, she thought, it might do more than that. There she might also find the courage to confront at last the fears that had troubled her for some time. What would become of her now that Mr. Bennet was gone? Where would she live? What could she do? These were questions so painful and so disturbing that she had not allowed herself to reflect upon them since his death, banishing them to the far corners of her mind, from whence they sometimes emerged to taunt her, at night when she could not sleep, after a particularly painful encounter with Miss Bingley or an afternoon with her mother. At Pemberley, freed from these provocations, she might become calm and rational enough to face the question of her future directly. And perhaps Elizabeth would help her. She was happy now, blissfully so, from all Mary had seen and heard. Surely Lizzie would not grudge a little time to assist and advise a sister who was so very far from enjoying that joyful state herself. Soon Mary had convinced herself this was the best course of action, and as she could think of no other, she decided not to go down to supper, but picked up her pen and began to write to Elizabeth straight away. She did not have to wait long for an answer, and a few days later, her scanty belongings secured on its roof, she clambered into the coach that was to take her to Pemberley. Mrs. Bennet did not come out to say goodbye. Early morning departures jangled her nerves. It was Jane who saw her off, standing on the steps alongside Miss Bingley, who waved her away with every appearance of regret at poor dear Mary's wholly unexpected departure.